So our passage then is the one that I read a few minutes ago, Hebrews chapter 9, verses 1 to 14. So although the book never gives us a definitive, explicit statement to this effect, almost certainly from the way that Hebrews was written, its first readers were being tempted in a particular direction. They were being tempted to desert Christ for what the writer calls at one point the Levitical priesthood, that is, those priests that had been stipulated within the law of Moses, those priests who descended from the tribe of Levi and who specialized then in animal sacrifices carried out in the temple in Jerusalem. These readers were being tempted to desert Christ for that. And of course, our author here, he doesn't approve then of that tendency at all. For him, it's the height of self-destructive madness. And in chapter 7, then, he has been very damning about these Levitical priests. In contrast to Christ, who continues forever, he has referred to these other priests rather disdainfully as mortal men, chapter 7, verse 8. And then he has pressed that point a bit further in chapter 7, verse 23. They were prevented by death from continuing in office, he has said. And he has then summarized the situation in these terms. The law, that is the law of Moses, appoints men in their weakness as high priests, chapter 7, verse 28. So in chapter 7, I'm saying he's been pretty damning about these Levitical priests. In chapter 8, however, he's been a bit more positive. Now, not in the sense that he's endorsing these priests after all and endorsing what some of his readers are doing and saying, well, it's okay then for you guys to re-engage with this system which you forsook when you first turned to Christ. No, he's not for one moment been doing that, but he's presented the Levitical priests more positively in chapter 8 in this sense. He has made it clear that that whole system with priests and a sanctuary and sacrifices, it wasn't pointless. It wasn't a meaningless exercise. Rather, it was a copy and shadow in the language of chapter 8, verse 5. Or in the language of chapter 8, verse 11, it was a teaching device. Perhaps we could sum it up in one word, it was a model. That whole Old Testament priestly, sacrificial, temple-based system, it was a model. Now, we're familiar, aren't we, with models in the days when Andrew Farker was around and John Patterson and Philip Smith, I suppose. It was a sort of semi-official NREC outing to go to a model railway exhibition every few months in Blyth or wherever it was being held. And I guess for many of us then, a model railway is a model railway because, just in a generic sense, the little trains model trains and the track models track and so on. But of course, for these guys who have their exhibits at these places, a model railway is a model railway in a much more specific sense. So one exhibit then, it will model a very particular kind of stretch of line, kind of 3.5 miles south of Crewe or something like that. And another exhibit, it will model a particular goods yard that's on the northern approach to Bristol Parkway or something like that. And so it goes on. They're very specific, these models. Or if you want to change specialisms, some of you will have been to the Discovery Museum in Newcastle and into that room there where there are all these model ships. And again, they're not just model ships in some generic sense, but each one specifically models a ship which was built in Newcastle and launched in the Tyne many years ago. And so that's the kind of thing that we mean then when we talk about models. And of course, this Old Testament system then, it didn't have small physical dimensions, like a model railway or a model ship. The temple was a huge building in Jerusalem, and the priests were full-grown adult men, and so on. So it wasn't so obviously a model in terms of its size, but it worked in just the same way as that railway or that ship. And in chapter 9 now, our writer develops then this theme. He develops this idea that the Old Testament Levitical system was a model. And in that connection then, I want us to consider three specific matters. First of all, the model's layout. The model's layout. And this is verses 1 to 7. So what then did this model, this whole Old Testament sacrificial system, what then did it really consist of? What did it involve in terms of its basics, its fundamental elements? That's the basic concern of our passage in verses 1 to 7. And in verse 1 then, the writer says that it involved two main components, regulations for worship and an earthly place. And in typical fashion, our writer then addresses those two things in reverse order. So in verses 2 to 5, he's taken up with the place that this model was centered on. And we're given a little tour in those verses of Israel's tabernacle. By the way, our writer tends to focus on the tabernacle rather than its more robust successor, Solomon's Temple. I don't think there's any major reason for that, except that our writer, many of his historical allusions come from the time of Moses and the Exodus and the wilderness wanderings and so on. And so it probably just seemed more natural, therefore, for him to focus on the tabernacle rather than on Solomon's Temple. And as I say, then we're given a little tour in verses 2 to 5, and different items within the tabernacle are pointed out to us. So that's verses 2 to 5, and then verses 6 and 7, they're taken up with the other main component of the model, the regulations for worship. That is to say, the activities of the priests within this tabernacle. And you'll notice a sharp distinction is made between the regular duties of ordinary priests on the one hand and the annual blood-dominated duty of the high priest on the other hand. And that's a reference, of course, to Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. That's what's been referred to when he mentions in verse 7 the work of the high priest. So that's then what this model looks like. That's its layout, and it's straightforward enough, and we don't really need to linger too long on this. I just want to quickly draw your attention to a couple of things. Number one, an emphasis, because there's a real emphasis in these verses on one feature of the tabernacle, and it's this: the way in which the tabernacle comprised two sections, to use the word that the ESV uses. It's actually, as you'll see from one of the footnotes, it's actually tent. When we have section here, it's actually in the Greek tent, and that becomes important a little bit later on. But there are these two sections then, or tents, the holy place and the most holy place. They're respectively referred to here as the first and second section or tent. That's because that's how they would have been experienced. If you were entering the tabernacle, the holy place would have been entered first. And of course, it was beyond that then that you had the most holy place. And I'm not going to say then anything more for the time being on this, but I just wanted you to note that emphasis on these two rooms or sections or tents within the tabernacle. So an emphasis. And then also, I just want to draw your attention to a detail. There's a little detail in verse 7 which I think is worth commenting on. We're told there then that the high priest's offering in the most holy place on that annual Day of Atonement, it was for the unintentional sins of the people. It specifically says that. Now that's an accurate description. So Numbers 15. It highlights that unintentional sins were indeed the type of sins that God's law made provision for. And it's very interesting that when we come to verses 11 to 14, as we shall do in a few minutes, the writer establishes in verses 11 to 14 a kind of point-for-point contrast, doesn't he? So this aspect of the Day of Atonement has been eclipsed by what Christ has done, and this aspect of the Day of Atonement has been eclipsed by what Christ has done, and so on. But there's nothing like that when it comes to this detail of the unintentional sins. So we don't have a line saying that the Day of Atonement has been eclipsed by Christ's work in this sense, that whereas the Day of Atonement was only concerned with unintentional sins, Christ's work is concerned with a broader category of sins. No, there's nothing like that. There's nothing to indicate that the focus on unintentional sins was unique to the Levitical system. In fact, when you come to chapter 10, verses 26 to 31, our writer seems to be saying that this is why for apostates now, in these new covenant days, there's no way back. Because that apostasy is deliberate, not an intentional sin. And so Christ hasn't provided atonement for that sin. Now that's obviously a very solemn thought, but I think, and this is why I wanted to highlight this, I think actually there's indirect comfort for us here. That for the writer, you see, the opposite of unintentional sins isn't intentional sins. For our writer, the opposite of unintentional sins is apostasy. That's what our writer is saying. And that's actually already hinted at back in Numbers 15, that passage I mentioned a moment ago, in Numbers 15, verse 30. The opposite of sinning unintentionally isn't simply sinning intentionally. The opposite of sinning unintentionally is sinning with a high hand. That's the phrase that Numbers uses. And I say then that this is of indirect comfort to us this morning for this reason. You see, we might think then that unintentional sins, that category only includes sins that, for whatever reason, are committed not really consciously. Perhaps sins that are committed in dreams, for instance. The Puritan Richard Baxter has a lengthy treatment on that specific matter. Sins that aren't really committed consciously. And then, of course, we look at our own sins and we see that many of our own sins aren't in that category, that they are committed consciously. They are sins that we could have avoided committing. And so we might think then, well, oh, crumbs, my sins aren't unintentional sins. And so perhaps they're not covered by the atoning work of Jesus Christ. If that only covers unintentional sins, what about mine that I've committed consciously? But I think that's a misunderstanding, you see, of this biblical concept. Let me quote one writer who I think puts it very well. He says this: a sin committed with a high hand, that's that phrase from Numbers 15, a sin committed with a high hand is not always the same thing as an intentional sin. All high-handed sins are intentional, but not all intentional sins are high-handed. The truly converted will not commit high-handed sins, though they may commit sins of intention, albeit only after and during a struggle against the flesh. Romans 7:7-25. And then he concludes that an intentional sin is not always a high-handed sin, is seen in God's willingness to forgive sins that were clearly intentional. 2 Samuel 11:12, referring there, of course, to David's sin with Bathsheba. And I think that's a very helpful assessment, particularly the reference to Romans 7. I mean, you think of Paul's anguished words there. For I do not do the good I want, but the evil I do not want is what I keep on doing. That's where you and I have been this past week, isn't it? That's the kind of sinning that we've engaged in. Sinning against our better judgment. Sinning, hating the fact that we're sinning. sinning, wishing deep down that we were worthier servants of our dear Lord Jesus Christ. And of course, that doesn't make it okay. It's still sin, and sin by definition is ugly and vile. It doesn't make it okay, but it does place that sin in a different category altogether from the person our writer has in mind there in chapter 10, who is brashly saying, forget Jesus Christ and his sacrifice. We don't need him. We're done with Jesus Christ. We're going to trust in something else now. We're going to trust in those glorious temple sacrifices that are still taking place in Jerusalem. That's high-handed sin. That brash, brazen rejection of Christ and of the gospel. I'm saying apostasy is high-handed sin. This past week, you and I, we've been covetous. Perhaps we've been lustful, we've been selfish, we've been unfaithful in our words, and so on. But by God's grace, we haven't apostatized. We haven't said, I'm done with Christ, I'm done with the gospel, it's a load of rubbish, and I'm turning my back on it. And yes, those sins that we have committed, they need to be repented of, they're serious enough, but in biblical terms, they are in the unintentional sins category. Covered by Christ's atoning blood. They're not in the high-handed category, the defiant, apostatizing category. And so we don't need to be worried about those kinds of ideas. So that's the first thing this morning, the model's layout. But then secondly, notice with me, the model's limitations. The model's limitations, and this is verses 8 to 10. And in this connection then, the limitedness of the model, I want to particularly highlight three concepts. First of all, access. Access. So just then as that train on that exhibit at the Model Railway Exhibition, just as that train will never actually take you into Crewe Station, just as that ship in that room at the Discovery Museum has never been, never will be launched in the Tyne and sail anywhere, in just the same way then, these priests in the Levitical system, they never really enjoyed access into the presence of God. That's a major limitation, our writer is saying, of the model. That no priest in that whole system ever really enjoyed access into the presence of God. And that's what he's saying then in verse 8. By this, the Holy Spirit indicates that the way into the holy places is not yet opened as long as the first section is still standing. Now, I don't want to be overcomplicated here, but it's at this point that I think the translation section there in verse 8 is unhelpful. Remember I said the word is really tense. So by this the Holy Spirit indicates that the way into the holy places is not yet open as long as the first tent is still standing. And I think in that phrase, first tent, here in verse 8, we have a deliberate wordplay by the author. So at one level then, he does mean, again, the first section, the first room, the holy place. He's talking about that. And he's saying then that as long as that was still standing, within the tabernacle itself, there was little access into the most holy place. Perhaps I could try and illustrate that. Think of a sports writer. And the sports writer, he works for the Chronicle, and he really wants to be at St. James's Park every match day and writing match reports on Newcastle's games. But in actual fact, all he's ever sent to is school sports days to write reports on those kinds of events. And his friends say to him, you know, one day you'll you'll be there in the stands at St. James's Park. You'll be reporting on those matches. And he might reply then, well, not as long as there are school sports days around. And of course, technically, you could challenge that and say, well, even if school sports days disappeared overnight, still it wouldn't mean actually that you would be kind of promoted to reporting at St. James's Park, because there are other people who are doing that and you might not have the gifts and experience and all the rest of it. But you see his point, not as long as there are school sports days around, because that's the only place I'm ever sent to report. And I think it's a bit like that here. You see, almost all priestly work was done in the first section, the first room, the first tent. It was almost synonymous with being a priest, was operating there. Almost all priestly work was done in that first tent. And so a priest in that Old Testament system, a priest might have said something like that sports journalist in my illustration, might have said, look, as long as this first tent stands, I'm never going to go into that other room, that other tent, the most holy place. And again, technically you could challenge that and say, well, even if the first tent was removed, then still you wouldn't, because you're not in Aaron's line and there are others who are doing it, etc., etc. But you see the point. As long as this first tent stands, I'm not going in there, because this is where most priestly activity takes place. And I think that's kind of what the writer is getting at here. And so he's saying, first of all then, that just within the tabernacle itself, forget the deeper symbolic significance of the tabernacle, and we'll come to that in just a moment, but even just within the tabernacle itself, that first tent very much restricted access into the second tent, because most priestly work was done there. And he's at the first level, he's saying that then. But then, as I say, I think there's a wordplay going on here. And he's saying then, at the second level, that the first tent there, I think it also stands for the tabernacle as a whole. In the first instance, it stands for the holy place, that first room. But within this wordplay, I think the first tent there, it stands for the tabernacle as a whole. Because, of course, the tabernacle as a whole was a first tent, because he's going to come to say, isn't he, in verse 11, that there's a more perfect tent. And so he's saying then that as long as that tabernacle as a whole was still standing, then no priest was able to enter the real holy, most holy place, the actual presence of God in heaven. He's saying that as well. And that's what he's referring to when he then says in brackets in our ESV, which is symbolic for the present age. Now, he doesn't mean there that the tabernacle was symbolic of the present age. He does mean it was symbolic for the present age, for the benefit of us in the present age. In the same way that Paul often says that the Old Testament, it was written for our benefit. And in the same way, the writer is saying here that that tabernacle, that first tent in the sense of the whole tabernacle, it was there partly to teach them things, but it was there for us as well, to teach us things as we look back on it now. And it's interesting that word symbolic, it's literally the word parable. It was a parable for the present age. It's the same word that we have in the Gospels, of Jesus' parables. And that's interesting, isn't it? Because we know, I've said this often before, that a parable was not merely an illustration. A parable, and you can go to Mark 4 and other passages to see this, a parable was a deliberately obscure teaching device. It concealed as much as it manifested. And it did that then to kind of discriminate between those who had the hunger to work through the obscure aspects of the parable and get to its kernel, and those who didn't have that hunger. And I think the writer is saying here that that tabernacle in the Old Testament then, It's a parable in the sense that for some of you readers of mine, some of you are being beguiled by it, and you think that that's the bee's knees, and that's the way to approach God, and you're wanting to go back to it. But those of you with eyes to see can see that actually it was just a model. Just a model of the real thing that our priest has entered into. And so the writer is saying then that this is the first limitation of the model, that there was no real access for any priest into the presence of God. Even if you just look at the tabernacle in its own terms, its own internal structure, there was no real access into its most holy place. And then if you look at the whole thing, it was preventing access into the true most holy place in heaven. So access, the second limitation, perfection. Perfection. And because then those priests weren't entering the presence of God, they weren't really securing what priests were meant to secure. What is that? He says in verse 9, they could not perfect the conscience of the worshipper. The purpose of the whole priestly system was to cleanse people's consciences. But because within that model, no priest was actually entering into the presence of God where priests needed to enter, therefore consciences weren't actually being cleansed. There's no capacity within that system for consciences to be cleansed. And the word perfect here then, we've seen this word before in Hebrews. We said it often means complete. Perhaps here we could say that there was no capacity to bring wholeness, completion, health, full health to the conscience. There was no capacity for that within that system. So he mentions the concept of access, the concept of perfection, and then thirdly, the concept of reformation. Because we have that word, don't we, then in verse 10? These things, they deal only with food and drink and various washings, regulations for the body imposed until the time of reformation. It's an unusual word. It's only used here in the New Testament. But reformation is quite a good translation, especially when we think of what our English word reformation really means. It means, of course, reformation, something being reformed. And the point here is then that that model, it needed to be reformed. It didn't need just another of the same kind of priest with the same kind of sacrifice to come along and just do things a bit better than all the others had. No, it needed to be reformed, taken apart, and refashioned completely. And so the writer is saying then that this model, just like the model railway, the model ship, this model, it was severely limited. No priest operating within that context really had access into the presence of God. Therefore, there was no perfection of consciences. And what was needed, therefore, was for the model itself to be reformed. And that's where we come to our third point. We've had the model's layout, the model's limitations. Thirdly, the model's logic. And this is verses 11 to 14. And it's interesting then how this logic does work. Because you'd have thought then the writer might say in verses 11 to 14 that because then the model didn't do anything, therefore obviously something that does do something, that does actually achieve something, is required. That's not quite how the logic works. What he actually says is that the model did achieve something. Didn't achieve a lot, but it did achieve something. He says in verse 13 that the blood of goats and bulls and the sprinkling of defiled persons with the ashes of a heifer, it's sanctified for the purification of the flesh. Now what that means is then that It's within the system. It made people ceremonially clean, as we often call it, so that they could participate in the life of the community. They weren't excluded, they weren't unclean and therefore having to be outside the camp, but they could participate fully in the life of God's people. So the model, it did achieve something, something very modest, but it did achieve something. And the logic there then is this: if you're into Latin, it's a fortiori logic. It's how much more logic. Because that's the exact language he uses, isn't it? If the model did achieve something, how much more is achieved when the model is reformed and Christ comes along and does his stuff? How much more is then achieved? And so just two questions as we close then. First question, how is it reformed then? How does Christ come along and reform the model and dismantle it and do his own thing? What does he do? Well, first of all, he enters the most holy place, the real most holy place, that no priest ever had entered. He actually does. That's what we've been told in verse 11. That he appeared, and that's not talking about his appearance here on earth when he was born, it's talking about his appearance having gone back into heaven. He appeared as a high priest of the good things that have come, then through the greater and more perfect tents. So he has actually entered that heavenly sanctuary. How has he been able to do so when no priest in the old system could? Well, he's been able to do so, the writer says, because he has offered a proper sacrifice. Not a sacrifice of animal blood, because, of course, it was absurd, really, to think, wasn't it, that animal blood could substitute for humans, that sinful humans could be atoned for by an amoral animal taking their place. Wasn't even an appropriate kind of substitution. It just didn't work on the most cursory inspection. It couldn't work. But now you see, the blood not of an animal, but of a human being, deals with the sins of human beings. And not merely any old human being, but a human being then who is without blemish, we're told in verse 14. And this now, of course, isn't without physical blemish like the animals had to be in the old system. And that was all just very pictorial. They had to be without physical blemish, no scars and blindness and maimedness and all that kind of stuff. But this now is without moral blemish. So here we have a proper sacrifice, a human being who is morally blemishless. And it is, we're being reminded again then, that this priest offered himself. Staggering, isn't it, to think of that? And by the way, it is fascinating, isn't it, that we're told that he did this through the eternal Spirit. It's kind of two great themes of Hebrews, isn't it? On the one hand, he's saying to his readers, don't desert Christ, because Christ is the great high priest who has really atoned for sins. Don't desert him. And then another theme is, in your perseverance, look to Christ as your example, because he had to persevere. And it's as if those two themes come together here in this verse, because he's really talking about Christ as the great high priest who has done everything. But then he kind of sneaks in this little reference. How did he persevere? How did he manage to offer himself? That's not easy. It was fiendishly hard for Christ to lay down his own life. How did he manage it? How did he persevere? The Spirit helped him. The Spirit enabled him to go through with it. And part of the significance of that is that, of course, these readers, they have the same Spirit. And the writer is surely at least hinting that you can persevere too, and you can come get to the end of your Christian lives faithfully, Because the same Spirit who gave him perseverance is there to give you perseverance. Perhaps you need to hear that this morning, because you're struggling to keep going as a Christian. And merely me saying, look to Christ as your example, he persevered. Well, what comfort's in that? That's Christ. Yes, but the same Spirit who enabled him to persevere has been given to you to enable you to persevere. You can do it. So how is the model reformed? How does Christ refashion it through really entering heaven and doing that on the basis of a proper sacrifice? But then, most importantly then, what is achieved through this? We said that the model, it achieved something. It achieved this kind of external purification that enabled you to join in with the life of the camp. What is achieved now as Christ reforms the model? Well, consciences are purified. That's what we said the model couldn't do. It couldn't perfect consciences. But we read in verse 14 that the blood of Christ, it purifies our conscience. It's interesting that, isn't it? You'd have thought that the great kind of climax here would be something a bit more objective than that. That the blood of Christ, it deals with our guilt objectively from God's end, rather than kind of focusing on our own subjective consciences and how it registers there. Is that really such a big deal? As long as we're forgiven, actually, does it really matter whether that registers in our consciences or not? Well, yes, it does. And the writer tells us why it does. Purifies our consciences from dead works. That's, I think, just in this case, just a reference to sin. To serve the living God. And the point is then that we can never fulfill the very purpose of our existence and our redeemed existence as Christians, which is to worship and glorify and serve God. We can never do that as long as our consciences are laden with guilt. The purification of our consciences is vital to give health and vitality to our service of God. Hugh Martin was a 19th century Scottish theologian, and he talks about this in one of his books, and he imagines then trying to worship God in a situation where our sins haven't really been dealt with and our conscience is cleansed. And of course, it's an impossible scenario anyway, but he just tries to imagine it. And he says this: my relationship with God in that case would be that of trembling obsequiousness and sycophancy. My great ruling motive in all my walk with him would be to keep off from dangerous ground, to avoid waking up an unfinished controversy. Soul-inspiring adoration would never stir my spirit. At the best, I would be only flattering God with my mouth. Meanly, I would be labouring to avoid provoking him to fall back upon the power over me, which in my uncancelled, undestroyed sin he still reserves. My religion would be a poor and pitiful calculation continually as to how I might best succeed in letting God's memory and my own slumber on a painful topic. There's no vitality to Christian communion with God unless the conscience is cleansed. And the conscience has been cleansed through Christ's work. Doesn't mean, of course, that we don't have to train our consciences. Doesn't mean that automatically our consciences will register that they have been cleansed. When I reverse into our drive with the parking sensors on the car, there's a wheelie bin in the corner, and you know the beeping starts to go off because the car's worried I'm going to bash into the wheelie bin. I can see in my mirror that I'm going to clear the wheelie bin. And so I have to train myself. I'm not going to listen to that beeping noise. Unfortunately, I can't temporarily disable it and switch it off as I reverse into the drive. And perhaps this morning, as you've been here in this service as a Christian, there's been beeping noises going off in your head. How can I worship God? Who am I to meet with these people and sing these words? I'm such a sinner. There's such dirt, such filth in my life. How can I approach the throne of God like this? And we have to train ourselves to shut off the beeper, to disable the sensor. And we have to train ourselves to think instinctively in terms of verses like this and the gospel as a whole. My conscience has been cleansed. My guilt has gone. And I don't need to feel laden with guilt when I'm worshipping my God. The writer says it calls this redemption, doesn't he? Verse 12, Christ has secured redemption. Because to be freed from a guilty conscience is nothing less than liberating. If you're a believer this morning, train your conscience to know it's cleansed. Train your conscience in the gospel to know that there's nothing now clouding your relationship with God. And if you're not a Christian this morning, don't you want a clear conscience? Perhaps sometimes at unexpected moments, in the middle of the night or something, suddenly you feel that sense that you do have a maker and you will have to stand before him. And there's loads of stuff in your life that makes that very problematic. Your conscience is rightly prodding you. And I'm saying the only answer to that is not to get up in the next morning and do a bit better the next day and be a more decent person. The only answer is to come to Christ and to know your guilt utterly removed and your conscience cleansed. And any of you can do that. Come to Jesus Christ this morning, the guilt remover, the purifier of consciences. Amen.